On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, I basically met a girl and ran away to the circus. You know, it was like my version of a midlife crisis. It was like I met a beautiful young woman and pitched it all.
Screenwriter Aline Brosh McKenna has written hits like The Devil Wears Prada and 27 Dresses. She wasn't looking to work in TV, but then she stumbled across satirical musical YouTube videos posted by a performer named Rachel Bloom. She tells us how Love at First Song led to the creation of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on the CW. But first on the news banter, not one, not two, not three, but four Avatar sequels. Someday. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hello there.
So, CinemaCon. CinemaCon was this past week in Las Vegas, a great gathering of theater owners who are looking at films that are upcoming. The idea is the studios come, they show especially summer movies. Everybody's supposed to get excited in the theater world and go out there and book these movies and push these movies and be happy about it. It's turned into quite an event and, you know, a place where news gets made.
Yeah, I mean, the studios have used it to announce new projects, and they know that now in the age of instant social media and web journalism that these announcements go way beyond the theater owners. So they're not actually the intended target. Really, it's the media who then reports on the fact that there's going to be now five Avatar movies and a new Deadpool and, you know, an Angry Birds sequel and things like that that they know is going to get a lot of attention.
So let me stop you at the five Avatars. There are four sequels. Jim Cameron went to Las Vegas, and this is one thing that people did not see coming. I mean, the first of these planned three Avatar sequels initially was supposed to be in the theaters in 2014. You might have noticed that it's not 2014 anymore, and there's been no Avatar sequel. So up pops Jim Cameron in Las Vegas to say, I am making four Avatar sequels, and the first one is supposedly going to be unveiled in 2018.
I will believe it when I see it. I mean, this is a famously meticulous filmmaker. He clearly has a vision for what he wants to do with this. But if I was Fox, I would be so pissed. I mean, he's just spending tens and hundreds of millions of dollars of their money to make these movies. And yes, they're going to be gigantic hits.
Theoretically, yes. Yeah, you don't want to bet against Jim Cameron. Yeah.
I mean, until this year, he had the number one movie of all time and the number two movie of all time. Avatar is still the highest grossing movie of all time. So I would definitely bet on the sequel to that movie. But they've got to be a little freaked. I mean, how long can this go on?
Well, we're going to find out because he is saying that he has a major vision and he's going to bring it to the public. And again, if it weren't for Titanic, everybody ridiculed Titanic and people were not too sure about Avatar. And he just, you know, was king of the world. And so we're careful when we express skepticism about Jim Cameron. Other news out of there, you know, Sony has had a very tough run with movies that weren't working. Tom Rothman, the thrifty new head of Sony, I mean new, he's been in the job a little more than a year, I guess, but known for not liking to risk and spend. He found this movie Passengers with Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt waiting for him. This was an original, considered a pretty risky and expensive proposition from Martin Tilden, the director of Imitation Game, first movie he's made for a U.S. studio. And Tom Rothman found it, I think, very hard to say yes to that movie at that number, you know, paying a lot to Jennifer Lawrence and setting a precedent for very high pay, which is absolutely against his religion. But the stuff they showed at CinemaCon, for what it's worth, really played well.
Yeah, people like the chemistry between Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. The Angry Birds teaser they showed for the upcoming animated film went over well. I wouldn't say it's a 100% win for Ghostbusters. There's still some questions about that film coming out this summer from Sony.
That's the Ghostbusters with the female cast.
I think overall Sony got high marks. Universal got high marks for their presentation, which included a lot of Jason Bourne and some announcements about the upcoming Girl on a Train trailer they showed, which is an an adaptation of the big book that's popular. The one weak studio I have heard was Paramount, who did not get very high marks for what they showed. There was some awkwardness with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles presentation, and Paramount doesn't have as many of these big blockbuster franchises that the theater owners love.
Yeah, it's tough for Paramount. You know, they're in the middle of this whole drama that we've talked about many times about whether Viacom will sell a stake in the studio. It's been, you know, just nothing but drama. And I don't envy those guys trying to even attract talent right now when they're in such a state of flux. Meanwhile, let's turn for a moment to television. Stephen Colbert, you know, he came into Late Night with a lot of passionate followers. He's done better numbers than Letterman, but he is being beaten by the competition, of course, really beaten by Jimmy Fallon and NBC, and sometimes beaten by Jimmy Kimmel on ABC. A little bit of retooling going on over there, and maybe the show, we don't know how it's going to change.
Yeah, last week they brought in Chris Licht as a showrunner, and this is an executive at CBS who has jumped around but is most recently revamped CBS Morning Show and has gotten a lot of high marks for that show. It still trails the Today Show and GMA, but the reaction at CBS was very positive to that revamp of the Morning Show, and now they're giving him Colbert's show. Colbert was essentially acting as his own showrunner and running the show while also hosting and writing a lot of it. I think this is an acknowledgement that the Colbert show, while it's doing fine and the ratings in the demo are up from what Letterman was getting, that they need to have more structure in the show. They need to have a definite kind of person in charge who can make moves and has experience running a network show like this. And I think that it will probably benefit Colbert. And this was all engineered by Les Moonves, who has a very good track record in this kind of thing. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, Colbert was spread pretty thin trying to be all things to that show. And it's, you know, it's not a 30-minute show on Comedy Central. It's a show on CBS, and it's, you know, it's an hour long.
And I could see them actually focusing on what has been a high point for Colbert is his newsmaker interviews. He's not as comfortable with the celebrities and the fun stuff like Fallon is, but when he has actual newsmakers on there, he's pretty good. And I could see someone coming over from the news division and really focusing on that and strengthening that.
I think he's really compelling when he plays that role. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. The premise of the quirky CW comedy Crazy Ex-Girlfriend can be summed up in a song. That's exactly what Rebecca Bunch, played by Rachel Bloom, does at the opening of every show.
I was working hard at a New York job, making dough, but it made me blue. One day I was crying a lot, and so I decided to move to West Covina, California. Brand new pals and a new career. It happens to be where Josh lives, but that's not why I'm here.
There are at least two original songs in every episode of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, performed by Bloom or Josh, played by Vincent Rodriguez III, or by one of Rachel's new friends or co-workers in the standard-issue Los Angeles suburb of West Covina.
West Covina, California. In my soul, I feel a fire, 'cause I'm heading for the pride of the inland.
Bloom created Crazy Ex-Girlfriend with our guest today, Aline Brosh McKenna. The successful screenwriter of films including The Devil Wears Prada and 27 Dresses, McKenna was not looking to work in television until she came across Bloom singing on YouTube. But before we get to that, we'll go back to the 1990s when McKenna was living in New York and struggling to make it as a magazine writer. Discouraged, she took a screenwriting class at NYU and wrote a script that got her an agent. She soon realized she needed to make the move to L.A., but still, it took a few years before her screenplays started to land.
The first movie that got made was Three to Tango. I think it came out in late 99 or early 2000. And then Laws of Attraction was the second movie that came out. And Three to Tango I worked on very closely and was close to the producer, and I was very involved in that process. And Laws of Attraction, I was involved almost not at all, and I've only seen that movie once.
Oh, something went
I was replaced on the movie, and it never came back to me, and they went kind of a different way with it. And so then I was working as a screenwriter, and I had various jobs. I was sort of making a good living, but I hadn't found the right collaboration, really. I hadn't found the right situation with a director.
We should say there are people who literally have entire careers as successful paid screenwriters and nothing ever makes it to the screen.
Right. Well, the funny thing was that when I came out here, I had sold that first script, and between selling the first script and getting the first movie made was 7 years.
Wow. That is long. Now it sounds like, yeah. Oh, yeah, 7 years. You got through that.
Yeah. You know, getting things made was sort of the first step. And then once I started getting things made, getting them made in sort of a way where I felt like my input was valuable and I was working with the right people. And I was very busy and employed, but then I had been trying to get on Devil Wears Prada for a very long time.
Did you read the book and think, I want this?
I had a meeting with a guy who worked for Wendy Finerman, who was the producer, and it was sort of a general meeting, and on the coffee table was the copy of Devil Wears Prada. And he said, what sort of things do you want to do? And I said, that. I want to do that. And he said, oh, well, that's not available, because they had another screenwriter on it. They then hired and fired four other screenwriters. And I kept saying to my agent, every time it popped free, just keep asking, keep asking, keep asking. So the woman who was the VP in charge of it was Carla Hacken. And I pitched to her a number of things that she passed on, including 27 Dresses, which later
became
a movie for Fox 2000. But
which is exactly where she worked.
Yeah.
Right.
But I had pitched her a number of things that she passed on. And then when Prada came up and they had gone through and it had been four men. And then they hired David Frankel, and they said to David Frankel, you can hire whoever you want. So when I got the call and I realized that, you know, David had worked in television and he'd worked on a lot of series, and I just assumed that he had like a bunch of writers in his pocket that he would want to hire. But because of Carla, I got this meeting and I went in and I just said everything I thought about the book and everything tonally I thought where they had gone astray. And because that was the big issue always with the book, was that the screenplay versions of it were a little pushed.
What do you mean by pushed?
The first thing I said to them was, fashion contains its own parody. We don't need to make fun of it. It's like Hollywood. It's silly enough on its own. You don't need to make any extra jokes. You don't need to push the comedy onto the fashion. If you play it just completely straight, it will be funny.
It's funny, right.
And so it just so happened that my take on the material was the same as David Frankel's, but I didn't know. I'd never met him before. I met him 1 second before I went into the room. And I just walked out of there thinking, you know what? I said what I wanted to do, and I just left it all on the table. And then somehow, miraculously, I got the job.
So how did it change your world? Did it change your world?
It really did. So I started working with him in late 2004, and the movie came out mid-2006. And from the second I started working on it until the day it wrapped, I worked on it every single day. So really the transformative part of the experience for me started with just this way of working really closely with someone.
Someone being a director.
Yeah, working closely with a director, knowing that we were on the same page and knowing that we shared a vision. And so I really felt for the first time like, oh, I really have a shot here. So for me, it was just, I really felt like that's where I learned how to make a movie instead of a document. You know, how to craft something that was going to be photographed instead of just what I had been doing, which was sort of like selling and making documents, the document production business, which is a lot of what screenwriters do, because you're writing so many more scripts than are being produced. So on Prada, it was like we knew we were making it. And then starting in maybe 5-6 months before we started shooting it, we knew we had Meryl. So I worked with Meryl also. So that was just a great creative experience. And then, of course, we had no idea that it would become successful. You just don't have any idea.
I mean, would you advise a young writer who, you know, would try to get with a director who's going to listen to you?
Yeah. I mean, that's the hardest, because in television, everybody wants to know what you think. It's all about what you think.
You're the creator.
And in movies, you can only have that by virtue of having a relationship with a director or sometimes a producer who gives you that access. Because a lot of times, like on my second movie, they took the script and went away and right. said, thank you very much. And I never saw anybody again.
Who said it? Robert Towne, throw your book across the border and then drive away if you want to be successful in Hollywood.
Yeah. So,
That's what people think.
I had had both experiences. And then Prada was really a successful collaboration all around.
So I guess that's where you really start to have 27 Dresses, Morning Glory. I don't know how she does it. We bought a zoo. I read a story I was hoping you would tell about in the middle of all of this somehow. You become a wife and mom. And I Don't Know How She Does It is the ultimate book about the working mom.
Yes.
And you had a situation which was actually that.
Oh, I had many situations that were actually that. You mean with being torn between the kids and the work?
Right.
I had many. I mean,
the one I'm talking about, you were in New York.
It was with Harvey.
Yeah, Harvey Weinstein.
My kids were pretty, you know, it was interesting because we were working on this book about parenthood and being a mother. And Harvey kept wanting me to fly back. After we tested the movie, we recut it a bunch. And he wanted me to be there for
in
all
New
of
York.
It, basically. He wanted me to be in New York for all of it. And I just couldn't. You know, my kids were little and I needed to be home. And there was just a day where I was in, Doug McGrath directed that movie, and he's like the most fabulous person. He's the funniest guy. And I was trying to leave and Harvey was coming up. And Doug's like, you got to go. You got to get to the elevator. So I took my roller bag and I got to the elevator. And the elevator opens and Harvey's standing there with his assistant.
And we should mention that he's an imposing person.
He is an imposing figure. And I'd been working with him for a
physically,
while.
Physically and in every sense.
And, you know, gift of gab. He likes to, he'll talk. So I said to Harvey, I got to go. I'm catching a plane. I got to go. And it was something specific that my son needed me for. It was some event, some school thing. So Harvey starts saying, well, who can we send? Don't you have nannies? Like, we can send somebody. I'll help you. I'll send somebody over. I'll send a gal over from the office. And the assistant is standing there holding my roller bag. And I'm like, Harvey, I got to go, man. I got to go. I said, this is what this movie's about. This is about this. And I got my bag and then really was sprinting through the airport. It was a nice irony. But God bless Harvey. He wasn't saying, like, nobody should be there with him. He was saying, I will provide you with someone.
Which is possible, right? But I mean, saying no to him, you know, a lot of people would be terrified to say no to him.
I loved Harvey. I think in the specific configuration that we were in on that movie, they were actually kind of great. That unfortunate thing about that movie is the book is so brilliant. It's one of my favorite books.
I recommend it.
Funny. It's so dark in a great way. And it's so British. And there were a bunch of mistakes creatively, I think, that I made on that movie. And one of them was we should have done it the way Bridget Jones was done. We should have kept it in England.
In Britain.
We should have hired a hilarious British actress. Sarah Jessica was wonderful, but we were trying to
transplant.
Not only that, we were trying to make it super mainstream, like mm-hmm. Mr. Mom-ish. And it wasn't really that. It was about the day-to-day. So it was a movie that needed to be, you know, a little bit more Alexander Payne and a little bit less trying to be kind of a mainstream commercial rom-com-y thing, because it never really was that. I am actually friends with Allison Pearson, who wrote the book, and I tried very hard to preserve it, but I think there was something about that kind of acid, self-deprecating British wit that just didn't translate.
Didn't translate. Well, let me just pause on, before we talk about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend to ask, because, you know, some of them work, some of them don't. You know,
yes.
We Bought a Zoo, Annie, those are ones that you worked on.
Yeah.
And how do you process when that happens? You say, oh, well, and...
They're all different. We Bought a Zoo, I feel like, and that was one where I had written the original draft and then Cameron Crowe came on and then Cameron Crowe reworked it.
Well, he's a writer.
In his way, he's mm-hmm. a writer. And I had sort of pictured Cameron Crowe and I like hanging out in my office and like eating caramels and putting together iTunes playlists. But that actually wasn't his process. He's actually never before or since come on to another writer's script, as far as I know. He's never made one that way. So I think that movie is kind of the spirit of what I was trying to do. There's a lot of really lovely, lovely things in that movie, like that really make me cry, that are really wonderful and really well done. What I had written was a little bit more of a comedy. It had a little bit more of that Mr. Mom thing. It had a little bit more of that aspect of a guy who really didn't know how to take care of his children. And then by taking care of these animals, he learned how to do that. But I have a lot of affection for that movie because I think there's a lot of sweet, warm things in that movie. Annie, I came in at a very specific time where they really needed a draft. So I did it very quickly. And then when Will Gluck came on, he really took it on and took it over, and he was lovely and called me and we had a nice conversation. But that was another one where I kind of did my job and then the process moved on without me, and I never saw it again until the premiere. So I've had, you know, I have credits on 8 movies, but, you know, there's some where I've been like really an integral part of the process, and then there's been some where I've been sort of more of a distant relative.
Coming up, McKenna tells us how Jane the Virgin helped bring about the miraculous resurrection of the seemingly dead Crazy Ex-Girlfriend pilot. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Aline Brosh McKenna, creator and producer of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. The CW musical comedy is just wrapping up its first season and was recently picked up for season two. The show stars Rachel Bloom as Rebecca Bunch, the so-called crazy ex-girlfriend, because she has given up a great job in New York and impulsively moved across the country to pursue an old flame from summer camp. As Rebecca attempts to win back her long-ago boyfriend, there are tongue-in-cheek musical numbers from every genre, rap, 80s hair metal, and this ballad in which Rebecca reproaches herself for antics that may have gone too far.
Lose some weight.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was not McKenna's first foray into television. She'd been there early in her career, and she didn't really plan to go back.
But then I saw Rachel's videos, and I just wanted to meet her. And this whole story is a process from, like, I'm just going to meet this woman and see maybe if I can help her do her own show. Cut to, that's my full-time job. That's what I do 24/7. It's completely subsumed everything. So, you know, I basically met a girl and ran away to the circus. You know, it was like my version of a midlife crisis. It was like I met a beautiful young woman. And
how did you happen to stumble across her YouTube videos?
I was procrastinating.
Okay.
And
good,
I was
good plan. My thing in favor of that.
As all writers
time.
Do. And I found her video on Jezebel. And I thought, God, who wrote this? This is so funny. Then I realized, oh, she doesn't only write these things. She sings them. And she's an amazing performer. So I went down the rabbit hole of watching all of her videos. And then I was just like, I'm a fan. I need to meet her.
Did you call her up and say, hi, I'm a person?
My best friend is Kate Adler, and she works at CBS. And every year she would call me and say, do you want to do TV this year? I know you're going to say no, but I have to ask you. So when I found Rachel, I called Kate and I said, why don't we meet with this woman and see if there's a TV show in it? At first, it was like, if we do it for big CBS, Rachel will not be in it. There's just no way they'll ever put it on the air with Rachel in it. So that meant cable. And then it turned out that Showtime was the one who bought it.
And Showtime, like, was very serious about it.
Oh, they were. It's funny. We had as good a development experience as I've ever had with anybody on anything. Making the pilot was great. They sent the script to Mark Webb.
Mark Webb being the director of Spider-Man.
Spider-Man, right? And 500 Days of Summer. So we had like this incredible team that we made the Showtime show with, and there was not a doubt in my mind that it was going to be a series. And we had a lot of conversations which sounded like, no, he's going to propose. No, he's invited you to Shudders. And he's, you know, he's like, it really seemed like we were going to have a show. And then as soon as we handed in a cut of the pilot, I was aware that tonally they were feeling like it wasn't Showtime-y. I got a whiff of that really pretty quickly as we were working on the cut. And really what it was not as edgy and dark as it had seemed on the page. And the reason for that is that Rachel is like a little beam of sunshine that you put in a bottle. I mean, she's just no matter how dark what she's or mean or confused or no matter how bad her priorities are as a character, there's just this beam of joy and sunshine that just comes pouring out of her. It took it out from being a kind of a dark, edgy, depressing show, which it had seemed a little bit more on the page, into this like it's a confection.
Right.
And so that it stopped feeling Showtime, I think, for them, because they do more like edgy,
shameless
dark,
and
dark, yeah, and
Homeland,
like dirty, and, you know.
Yeah.
Our pilot was pretty dirty, but it was not...
not dirty enough.
It was not depressing.
Not depressing. So that must have been a horrible feeling. You just are so ready to have the baby,
yeah,
and then there's no baby.
CBS immediately rallied with, you know, we'll send it everywhere. And luckily, there's all these outlets now, many of which I'd never heard of. And so we went on this giant list of like networks, new networks that were like, you know, whatever product, you know, whatever thing. It was like
Freeform something.
Yeah,
is it
great.
A
never heard of it.
Or
great.
A network.
Yeah. If they're doing, you know, and people would call you and say, oh, so-and-so is doing original programming now. You know, it's like Kmart's doing original programming now. Eggo Waffles is doing. I was like,
yay,
great, whatever, I'll take it. So we were sending it to all these places. And then I had time on my hands, so I had time to finally watch Jane the Virgin, which everyone had been telling me to see. So I watched Jane the Virgin, and as soon as I started watching it, I texted Rachel and I said, you know, it's nothing like our show, but it's like our show. Like, there's just there's something about the DNA of that show, which is it's like formally very interesting. It has this central kind of magnetic lead, you know, and I just thought, if they're doing that, maybe they'd be interested in us. And there happened to be two fabulous women who work at the CW in the development department, Joanna and Gay, and they loved it, and they passed it up to the ranks to Tom Sherman, to Mark Pedowitz, to so that's how we got there. That's how we landed there. It was all a lot of kismet.
So now, I guess the next question is, how do you figure out how to put it together with these songs? Like, what is the chicken and what is the egg in terms of
with the songs?
Yeah.
Well, the songs are the egg. I have that answer. You know, we always design the show to be like a great standalone show with or without the song. So the songs are always dictated by the show, characters, emotions, storyline, through line. And a lot of songs get tossed in the development phase because they don't fit in with the episode. We have three songwriters. They all do something else full time on the show. That's what's weird. So Rachel writes songs, Adam Schlesinger writes songs, and this gentleman, Jack Dolgen, writes songs. Rachel is obviously our star. Adam produces all the music, and Jack is a staff writer on the show. So everybody is kind of involved in the development of the show and the story. And then when we realize, okay, this song is definitely going to be in that episode, then they start writing it. And they decide Rachel will write this one, Jack will write this one,
so
Adam will.
So the song is an idea as opposed to a song.
The song is an idea for a very long time in the script. We knew we were going to do two songs per episode at least. We had 18 episodes. We ended up doing 49 pieces of music, which is way more than I ever thought we could do. It's largely due to the fact that Rachel and Adam and Jack also are able to collaborate and get, once they have a good idea, the demo will come in pretty quickly. And then we often have 1, 2, 3, 4 locations where pieces of the song take place. And that's really where we end up. There's a couple places where we end up economizing. One is we probably for each song would love to have 1 or 2 more locations for the actors to sing in. And we just can't, we don't have the time or the money. And then the other place is we always want to maximize the number of dancers that we can have, and that's very expensive. And so we will have numbers where there's no dancers, and then we'll kind of save up for a number where we have a lot.
So like a big moment, more dancers.
Yes, exactly. So each song is a different scale. I mean, if it's Rachel singing You Stupid Bitch by herself on a stage, then we don't need a big dance number.
Which she does sing.
Yes, she does. In the pilot, we had a huge dance number with 75 dancers and 50 extras, and we can't do that very often in our episodic. We do that as much as we can.
I mean, you've been somewhat the ultimate bubble show in a way. Like, you know, a lot of the predictions, people predict this isn't going to be renewed, this will.
Right.
And you're hearing people say you're not going to be renewed, and then Rachel wins a Golden Globe. Does that, you think?
That helped. That really helped. I mean, our ratings are not spectacular. I'm hoping that when all episodes go up on Netflix that people will binge it, because I think it's very much that kind of show. And I know that Jane the Virgin benefited from that. But yeah, Rachel being nominated, I mean, even that was just a huge help. And then the fact that she won was just sort of brain exploding. And then she won the Critics' Choice Award. And it's just been so gratifying and awesome. And then sometimes she and I look at each other and just go, my God, that pilot was in the garbage can. It was in the garbage can. And so we feel like we always feel very grateful, like we narrowly missed, you know, being consigned to the watery grave where all the dead pilots live.
Aline Brosh McKenna is the creator of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you, Kim.
The season one finale of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which marks McKenna's debut as a director, airs April 18th on the CW. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Not asking to be your fiancé, but if tonight or tomorrow, if you happen to be free...